Cliffcentral. The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Reports. Hello, Ramon.
Hey, what? Everything good?
Living the dream.
Look at us, 7 p.m. on a weekday, recording. Who says this is an easy job? I'm not even getting paid
job,
for this.
Yeah, I was just going to say, where's my money, bitch?
Where's my white privilege that makes me not work for free? Where's Kosatu to save me from this exploitation?
They've been in disarray since Swelen Zima shags his secretary on the desk.
Yeah, and they've been too busy sending teachers' posts to people in return for 50% of their salary. Did you know that?
Say that again.
Satu have been selling teachers' posts in return for 50% of the salary that teacher gets. I think in the private sector that's called labour broking. I thought they were against labour broking.
Well, not if it's in their interests. Like most politicians aren't against things in their interests.
Right. But this is of no interest to us. Let's get cracking.
Yeah. Why don't you introduce our esteemed guest?
So, today we have another PhD, Jonathan, I hope you know. I think this is the sixth one on the Renegade Report.
We're collecting them.
We are indeed. Yeah,
we've got their heads in a jar just out back, so...
Well, they're worth more than the PhDs, I suppose. Ouch.
You got to give them the compliment and then take it all back, hey?
So, we have Jason Werbeloff. He is an author of science fiction. He is a philosopher. And what else do you do, Jason?
That's it for now.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Well, welcome to the show. Good to have you on, especially on a weekday at 7 p.m. But nevertheless, we are going to discuss how to construct a good philosophical argument. Now, this is very rare in South Africa, all the way from Parliament to the streets. People don't know how to do arguments correctly. But let's break it down for the average person who doesn't understand philosophy. So think about if you're talking to Jonathan, how would you describe philosophy?
Jonathan looks like an intelligent guy, so
looks odd to see
wouldn't him. Be too difficult to describe it to
I'm
to
just
Jonathan.
Taking the knock, say.
So philosophy is the love of wisdom, and wisdom is composed of asking difficult questions, fundamental questions. And when we answer these questions, we need to have criteria for what counts as a good answer or a bad answer. And we use logic to determine whether you've supported your answer well or poorly. So we use logic as a set of criteria or judging criteria to decide whether or not you are justified in holding your beliefs.
Right. So is the point of philosophy, is it to find truth, or is it to find an understanding, or is it really to have a debate between two people and try have a favorable outcome for both?
All of those. Right. So ultimately, we do aim at truth with a capital T. Most philosophers would agree that there is truth with a capital T. We think that there's an objective truth, and we're trying to arrive at that using strong objective arguments. And once you have beliefs about the truth, we say you have understanding. And yes, we want to conduct conversations between people where those conversations are conducted in an amicable way with principles that everyone agrees on to try and arrive at some sort of ultimate understanding.
All right. So now there are various ways to construct an argument. What are the easy ways to look at arguments? First of all, what is an argument? If you could define that for us.
So an argument is a set of propositions or statements which can have a truth value. In other words, they can be true or false. So it's a set of statements that support another statement called a conclusion. So it's any set of statements where one of them is a conclusion which is supported by other statements. And if those statements which support the conclusion, in other words, premises, if your premises support your conclusion well, we'd say it's a good argument.
Right. But you can have correct premises, a correct conclusion, but still be wrong.
Well, it depends what you mean by wrong. Okay, so
not truthful.
Yes. So philosophers, when you look at an argument, we evaluate a few things. We ask whether your premises are true, and then we ask, even if your premises are true, do they guarantee the truth of the conclusion? So, for example, let's say you're doing a poll, okay, before the election. Before this election, you poll a bunch of people and you ask, so who are you going to vote for in the upcoming election? And you poll, say, a lot of people, but not the whole population. You poll, say, 10% of the population. And that 10% says, we're going to vote. Some of them say we're going to vote ANC. Some of them say we're going to vote DA. You look at the proportion of people voting for each party and you say, okay, based on this information, we predict that the election results overall, when the whole population is voting, will have a certain proportion, the same proportion. So that sort of argument is a strong argument, but the truth of the premises don't guarantee the truth of the conclusion. Your poll might be bad. There's bad polls that we see all the time. So that's a good example of an argument where, yeah, your premise might be true, you've polled people correctly, but your conclusion isn't necessarily true, that everyone in the general election will vote that way.
Okay, so it seems like the problem we have in our sort of societal dialogue these days is that we don't even have true premises. So we have a lot of ideas that aren't based. I assume to get to a premise, you have to have some sort of data point which would allow you to arrive at that premise, assuming you want the premise to be truthful.
Correct. So do you have any examples that you...
Well,
I've got one.
You can throw it right down.
All white people are racist. I am white, therefore I'm a racist.
Right. So it's true that you're white, Roman. I'm looking at you. I think it's true, although we're going to actually get into that a bit later.
He loves talking about this French-Arab nonsense, but he's definitely white, man.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's a very good point. You know, when you use terms in your premises, you've got to define those terms. So we've got to define what we mean by white. We've got to define what we mean by racist. Because only once you understand those terms fully can we really get to grips with whether those premises are true or false. You can't say whether a statement is true if you don't understand the terms of that statement.
But do you think people obfuscate the terms on purpose? From my side, I have a lot of debate on Twitter and offline. And people make a declarative statement about something. They say that's racist. And then when you ask them, what does racist mean? It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Correct.
Some use a dictionary. Some use this pseudo power structure thing. Some use, I don't know what else they use. But no one can actually tell us what racism actually means.
Right. So, this is something that I'm very interested in as a philosopher. And it was the topic of my PhD thesis, was trying to understand what the meaning is behind social terms like a social group or a race group or discrimination. And philosophers do some good work on this. So, for example, there's a philosopher named Altman, and Altman writes the Stanford Encyclopedia article on discrimination and provides what she thinks is the best definition for discrimination, and then starts to take it apart and show what the problems are. And the problem with everyday discourse with people is that they're not necessarily providing coherent definitions. As you say, they're switching between definitions. They often define their terms in terms of other terms, which they then define back in terms of their original terms, and there's a circularity in their definitions. And we have to be really careful, especially when we're judging people and moralizing about their behavior. We've got to be really careful that we know what we're actually talking about. We've got to define our terms well.
All right. So give us the example. I know you have already, about that circular logic and that circular argument.
Right. So one of the popular academics today writing about privilege and whiteness is Samantha Weiss. She was a colleague of mine. And Samantha Weiss defines whiteness, and she defines privilege in terms of whiteness. But if you ask what whiteness is, she'll define that in terms of privilege. So it's very important not to define terms in terms of other terms which you define back on themselves. We need to ground our social terms in ways which someone who doesn't already believe in the existence of those terms, that those terms refer to objects in the world, will accept. We've got to ground those terms in terms of other terms that we all agree to. And you see, if you don't believe in privilege initially, and you define privilege in terms of whiteness, and you don't already agree with notions of whiteness, it's not going to help your interlocutor to understand.
All right, so So let's get into this whole, I mean, that was your PhD essentially talking around this type of stuff. Let's get into the, you know, there's whiteness, there's blackness, there's, we've discussed it on this podcast many times, these collective groupings, black pain, white tears. What else have we got?
White privilege, dude.
Yeah, white privilege, of course, as
we've discussed. Because you don't even know white privilege, it shows that you've got it.
Well, clearly, you didn't mention of course. So we've got all these sort of terms which have kind of, well, not kind of, they've been made up. They didn't exist. So if you'd gone to someone 5 years ago and spoken to them about black pain, they would have been like, is that a band? Right. You know, is it a horror movie I didn't see?
Right.
Tell us what you think about groups and collectives.
So there's not a problem per se with inventing a term to describe something. The problem is when you start loading that term with normative features. In other words, you say that there's something wrong with being that thing, or there's something good about being that thing. So it's good to be part of the Black Power movement, or it's wrong to have white privilege. So you can invent terms for what you see around you, but as soon as you start loading it with moral judgments, you can't construct moral judgments out of thin air. You know, you need to ground them, and you ground them with well thought through arguments. You asked about social groups, so my thesis was it basically argued that there are no social groups, or at least the claims that we have around social groups are very unclear, and that the view that there aren't social groups is at least as good as the view that there are social groups. So let's look at whiteness, for example. So As a philosopher, what I'd like to have is the person who is claiming there's whiteness, I'd like a definition. So what do you think whiteness is? I'm sure Roman has heard a few definitions. Roman, can you throw one at me?
Well, whiteness is how can I explain it? I don't even know. There's so many. There's a historical context whereby certain structures of society see you in a very positive light. And you have privilege because the society was built for you by your kind.
Okay.
That's one.
So you're defining whiteness in terms of privilege. So now I'll ask, okay, so what's privilege?
Privilege is not being followed around in the shopping mall because you're white. Therefore, you're more trustworthy. That's what I heard.
There's so many. It's a great definition of privilege. Also around the Penny Sparrow time, privilege was not being called a monkey. Privilege. But privilege seems to be if you have stuff.
No, I've got one.
Or you have standing.
One. There's a societal bias to make. That infers that white people are better than other races due to historical and political context.
Okay. So what we're looking for as philosophers are what's called necessary and sufficient conditions. So what we want to know is under what conditions do you have whiteness and under what conditions don't you have whiteness? Or another way of asking the question is what are the conditions under which you're a member of the white social group, of the white race, and what are the conditions under which you're not a member of the white social group? So what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for whiteness? And those are very hard to provide. So if your condition is that you have certain things and don't have other things, that's not going to work because you get some very poor white people, but they're still considered white.
Right.
So that's not going to be a necessary condition. So we need to provide these conditions in order to understand the concepts that we're using. And if we can't provide those conditions, then it's not clear that we're using a concept that refers to anything actually existing in the world.
I mean, I agree with you completely. Define your terms is the first port of call. And they hardly ever defined. And I just want to aside quickly. Do you think it's done intentionally or are these concepts just very new?
I think
there's a perverse way that these are vague on purpose.
Yeah, I think it could be a combination of both. So it could be that because they're new, they can be perverted very easily because they don't have a strong following already in terms of a defined, coherent definition. So it could be that, whiteness is a very new term, so we can bandy it around in different ways and use it in different senses. And the moment an objector, someone who doesn't believe in the existence of whiteness, pins them down to a definition, they just switch up the definition. So that could be what's happening. But it could, as you say, be slightly more malicious. malicious than that. So it could be that someone has an axe to grind and they're just inventing a term that accurately reflects how they feel about certain things that are happening in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the sort of ongoing silencing that's happening, yes. Which is, so, you know, whiteness applies to all of us. And unless essentially you're one of these sort of guilty whites who goes on Twitter and says things like, until white people apologize for everything they've done over millennia, they really can't consider themselves part of the human race going forward. Those types of concepts, right. and so it's often Ramon and I get this on a regular occasion where we'll get, don't you dare mention, I don't want to see you in my mentions again, my mentions. You have no right to speak because you're white.
Right. And
this isn't a pity party for us. We couldn't care less. So it's not to, we don't give a shit, but this is the type of stuff that's happening to people in general. I know a friend recently was giving a presentation, said something quite flippantly as a joke and was, instructed to withdraw the comment at the end because someone couldn't take a joke, basically. And so that what's going to happen to him is he's going to self-censor from now on, essentially.
Hopefully not.
Well, he will, because, you know, it was at work and it created a bit of an unpleasant environment, and he can't afford to do that at his job. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this stuff seems to be about pushing forward an ideology, a specific ideology, silencing the other side. And I think, you know, what Ramon started with in terms of the arguments is that these things aren't based in the arguments, but there are some people pushing these ideas forward who understand a bit of philosophy, you know, not at your level, but they've certainly done a first year course and read a little bit. And so they kind of know how to circumvent the entire system. So how do you get someone who has such an innate belief in something that is so untruthful, where you can show them these types of facts, where you can say, but this isn't true, what about this or what about that? And they, you know, we off air were discussing that when you go to a fundamentalist and you show them what they believe is incorrect, they don't back down, they double down. Yeah. So what's the sort of philosopher's approach or technique to kind of trying to get through to these people?
So there's two techniques. The one is to walk away and not engage in the discussion.
Okay, not an option for either of us.
Right. The second one is to try and establish ground rules. And those ground rules really are logic. Okay, so what we do is we say, okay, would you agree with these rules for argument? You know, and you give examples. So here's one. It's wrong to criticize a person's argument by criticizing a person's character. Mm. So let's say you don't like someone. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can't say anything true, right? Mm. So, for example, Frege. Frege's been accused. He was a classical mathematician and philosopher. He came up with a phenomenal philosophy of language and mind ideas. He was an excellent logician and mathematician. But people have said, oh, well, he was anti-Semitic, and so therefore his mathematical theories are all false.
Hmm.
He may have been anti-Semitic, and that may have been a problem with his character, but that doesn't necessarily mean his math is bad.
Yeah.
So I would first ask, a fundamentalist. So do you agree that sort of argument, which we call an ad hominem, where you attack someone's argument based upon attacking their character, would you agree that kind of argument is no good? And I'd give the Frege case, and I'd say, okay, yeah, sure, all right. And then I'd say, okay, well, look what you're doing to me. It has the same structure. Okay. What you're doing to me is saying, I can't have a view because I'm white. So you're objecting to my character, and in so doing, arguing that nothing I say can have any value, even if what I say is identical with what you say. Just because I'm white, I can't present anything of value.
It's a great example. So essentially, even the people we hate the most or have the most disagreement with, who sit on the opposite side of the spectrum, wherever it may be, may say truthful things.
Absolutely.
And so our feelings towards them are rather irrelevant.
Of course it's irrelevant, but it's very important in philosophy that your interpretation of the opposite argument is extremely charitable.
Correct.
So even if, for example, Eusebius, Mackayser, if I'm in a debate with him one day, who knows,
doesn't debate people.
No, he doesn't debate people, but let's say he does. If I were to have a debate with him and he has this whole thing about structural whiteness, I would try to be very charitable and say, okay, what exactly are you trying to say? Are you talking about structure as in economics, as in the institutions of the country, as in a lack of representation of black people in X field? Is that what you're talking about? It's sort of, it's charitable and trying to define the terms.
It's what I want to get onto next, which is the, you know, ad hominem is what you come across commonly on social media. Sometimes it's not as, you know, it's not necessarily the whiteness example. It's just like, oh, you're an idiot or something like that.
Even idiots can say true things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The what Ramon's referring to is something that's sort of been coined as steel manning. Mm-hmm. So looking at the opinion of your opponent as a strong opinion, trying to prop that opinion up as much as you possibly can,
and then object,
and then objecting to the strongest version of their of what you believe their views to be. We get the reverse a lot, which is, and everyone loves to call everything anyone says as well, which also drives me crazy. A straw man. Yeah. So give us sort of a philosophical definition of straw manning.
So straw manning is where you deliberately interpret your opponent's argument in a weaker form than your opponent either intends, or in a weaker form than it could be interpreted as. So the way Ramon described it is very good. So as philosophers, what we try and do, Daniel Dennett wrote down some really good laws for engaging people. He said, the first thing you do is you try with as much charity as possible, he calls it the principle of charity, with as much charity as possible, interpret their view in the most plausible light. And then only do you attack it. What's happening in our public discourse is that people are deliberately undermining each other's views before they can even engage with them. And the problem then is that there's no arriving at truth or understanding, as you said at the beginning of the podcast. There's no pursuit of truth. There's only the pursuit of winning the argument. But I think it's far less interesting to win an argument than it is to come to a common agreement about a truth. At the end,
I prefer winning.
But I think
I prefer winning when I'm right.
But winning is rather pointless if you don't get people to come over to your side. I mean, you can have the answer to life,
yes,
but unless you can convince people and you know a large majority that you're right, your side, you'll die with your correct answer to life, with nobody believing you or agreeing with you.
Yeah, I mean, one of the tenets of philosophy is that you need to present your argument in a way that a perfectly rational person who has no background in philosophy or any of the terms that you're discussing could understand. If he applied himself, he could understand what you're talking about, and he would find your argument convincing. If your argument won't be convincing to an opponent who doesn't already agree with your view, then there's no point in presenting that argument, and it begs the question. It's another philosophical term. It begs the question. In other words, you're assuming the thing that you're trying to prove.
Doesn't religion do that quite well?
Yes. So, for example, if you ask many religious people why God exists, they'll say God exists because the Bible says that God exists. Okay. But the problem is, in order for the Bible to be correct, it must have been written by God. So God must have existed. So it's a circular argument. It's assuming the thing that it's trying to prove. It's assuming the conclusion that it's trying to prove. So built into the premises of the argument is the conclusion. So it's a circular argument, or it begs the question.
But it must be maddening being a philosopher in this day and age, because we discussed this before the show. I mean, I don't think there ever was a time when people were reasonable. Let's talk reasonable. And
hating words. I'm losing rational. I've lost problematic.
No, rational.
Killing me.
Problematic is a shit word to use. But a lot of people think we're actually being dumbed down. I don't think so. I think we're just learning the wrong ideas. Or we learning about ideas in a way that is detrimental to us, and us, I mean, as a collective. Because I don't think we'll get anywhere in the future if we don't have a basic understanding of what we're discussing. I mean, do you think people are reasonable, or is it just the fact that we actually aren't at all, and it's trying to do that, which is the point?
I don't know if people are becoming more or less reasonable, but I know it's becoming more fashionable to be less reasonable. So it's becoming fashionable to be closed-minded. And the reason for this is that people build an echo chamber around themselves. They surround themselves with people who have the same views as they do. And anyone who doesn't have that view is automatically excluded from that echo chamber. Yeah, a group. So people surround themselves with other individuals that they think share the same beliefs as them. They classify themselves as a group. They build up a following. And once that happens, it's very hard to engage anyone in that group, especially within social media circles. Very hard to engage anyone without being shouted down. And the problem is that, you know, as philosophers, we believe that it's the content of your argument that counts. It's what you're saying. It's not how loudly you're shouting it, or whether you can get lots of people to clap for you as you shout it and like your posts. And now there's all sorts of reactions on Facebook, like love. And, you know, the question for philosophers is not whether your opinion is popular. The question is the content of what you're saying. Is that good content? Do your premises adequately support your conclusion? Are your premises true? These are the questions philosophers ask. And unfortunately, those are not the same questions that are asked today, and it's not popular to ask those questions. What's popular is to present a view which everyone likes. You get lots of likes for it or follows. And that's not helpful at arriving at the truth.
Okay, so it's interesting because what you've just said now and what you were describing at the beginning of the show, we've had societal sort of views that change. Let's take gay marriage. Let's just take being gay as an example. You know, 100 years ago, basically it wasn't socially acceptable. It's interesting because obviously 1,000 years ago it may have been very socially acceptable.
Right. So these things go through.
Yeah, they go through flux, sort of these phases, but wasn't really acceptable. 50 years ago, it was kind of bubbling under the surface, still not acceptable, but there was definitely something that was going to happen. And we've reached the point now where we've taken a very liberal stance, which I'm perfectly happy with.
Sure.
And I would hope most people are.
Look at you virtue signaling.
those bloody guys. Right. So the thing is where's the role of philosophy in, and philosophers and thinking and getting people to have this type of thinking in the way society behaves? And is there any role, because are we all just apes, really, and tomorrow if the whole earth was kind of destroyed and we had nothing but the forest left, would we just revert to being apes? You know, that argument that's been made a couple of times by some well-known philosophers. Or is there an argument to be made for kind of getting people to question these things a little bit more closely?
Yeah. Within academic circles, philosophers have a lot to say about these issues. It all falls under the branch of ethics.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's tons of ethics written out there. I have lectured ethics a few times. Everyone has very strong intuitions about ethics. Unfortunately, though, academic philosophy is not very accessible to laymen. And because of that, as you were describing, the role of philosophers in discussing these issues, because of that, the role of philosophers is not as strong in society as it should be or as it could be.
It just seems to me like Daniel Dennett should be a household name as much as Beyonce is.
Right, but you don't see people, you know, quoting Daniel Dennett's lyrics. You know, that.
No, he doesn't have as nice a rear end. I mean, let's be honest.
Right. You know, philosophy is not as sexy as Beyonce. I think there's two areas in which philosophers are doing good work to try and fix that problem. The one is philosophers like Alain de Botton. I really like his work. Roman
really?
Looks very unimpressed.
No, I was very underwhelmed by his work.
Okay, tell us
more. Alain de Botton is a Swiss.
Oh, I love the French accent.
Well, he is French. Very Swiss, actually. But anyway. No, he writes very accessible philosophical. They like essays, really. They books on travel was one, and so he just goes through various philosophical ideas about certain things that happen to us on a daily basis or during our lifetime. What do the philosophers say about traveling, or what do they say about loss, or what do they say about this? It's very accessible. It's not bad. I just find it a bit simplistic.
It's not geared to be high philosophy. It's purely geared to engage the masses. And he has he's created a school, you could call it. He calls it the School of Life. and they've produced all sorts of YouTube videos, 3-4 minute videos on all sorts of topics and everything from how to leave your relationship to whether you should get married, to have children, like real life topics, racism. He's got some excellent material, which is very brief, but very, very punchy. And even though it is simplistic, if you look at it from a philosophical point of view, a lot of the content is not content that most people are thinking about. The second area in which philosophers are trying to make inroads, and I'm one of them, is that I write philosophical science fiction. So I write my philosophy into fiction rather than into nonfiction. I find that nonfiction is often inaccessible to people, but when I write it as fiction and bury my philosophical ideas within the fiction, not too explicitly, but it's there.
Engaging story. Well, it's the same way that Marxism has been embedded in all kinds of children's literature.
Right. So hopefully I'm not doing the same thing as Marxists are trying to do.
That's Enid Blyton, isn't it? The Fantastic Five.
Well, it's not Roald Dahl, that's for sure.
And there I think you can try and get across philosophical ideas in a way that's more accessible to the everyday Joe on the street.
So in your opinion, do you think philosophy serves a daily purpose?
I think it should.
Or it should, rather.
I think it should. I think if everyone did a logic course, a philosophy 101 logic course, the world would be a very different place.
Ah, but you did used to teach this kind of stuff,
yes,
and you gave it up, and tell us why.
It's your fault, yes.
It's my
Jason,
fault.
Or your fault.
I do still teach it to people who are willing to listen, but I don't teach it at university anymore, because there is massive antagonism towards what many students consider patriarchal, colonial, white logic. It's often argued that the system of thought is inherently oppressive and discriminatory and racist and problematic.
And so you can't get through to people who judge you before you've opened your mouth.
Yeah, it was an enormous challenge to get through, to break that block, an enormous challenge to get students to treat me not even with an initial belief that what I'm saying is correct, but just to dismantle their skepticism, their cynicism and skepticism.
Or tell you why you're wrong.
Yes, and just to engage in debate rather than dismissing me purely because I'm a white male lecturer. Very, very difficult. And although I think it's a worthwhile project and it was rewarding in certain ways, by the end of the last course I taught, I felt there was just so much resistance.
Well, the worst part is that they can have a black female lecturer now and they will still reject the content because it's colonial. So, and these are the problem with these arguments is that even if you fix the so-called problem, there's another problem until the entire structure which they have a problem with doesn't exist.
Correct. But even then, they could argue that that structure persists through other forms.
Well, you know, the institutional racism where there is no institutional racism.
Correct.
Still,
anyone who listens to this podcast, I want to know about the institutional racism. Let's look at the state. I want to know if the black president, the black chief justice, the black head of the police, the black head of the NPA, the 80% black MPs in parliament, and the over 90% black mayors in the country, and over 95% black police officers. Please show me institutional racism. I'll wait.
And you know what they're going to say? They're going to try to throw the private sector in your face.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Because apparently what... So, like, your plumber is, like, institutionally racist. Get out of here.
And let's not forget that if your plumber wants to be institutionally racist, he damn well is allowed to be, because that's a private entity. So...
Well, it's illegal now.
He has... We may not agree with him and may not use his services, and that's what you would hope the free market would do, but that's the rights of people and their private property.
We have to ask some difficult questions, and we have to demand answers to those questions. So one of the questions is, under what conditions is an institution racist? That's the fundamental question we've got to ask. What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for an institution being racist? Mm. As Rahman said, some of those conditions, which we might assume, don't seem to be being met in certain areas, like in government representativeness. So we might ask, in what sense is government still institutionally racist? And we need an answer to those questions. If a good answer can be provided to those questions, then we can look at addressing institutional racism.
And I think on some levels, a lot of those claims have been addressed. I look at universities, for example, who've turned around and said, Well, you know, you're correct. Our staff are UCT, what was it, 75% sort of, I think white, I'm not sure male, but certainly white. And they did look at addressing that. And as far as I know, they have started addressing that in trying to balance, you know, the staff complement. Of course, that's difficult because people at universities are by definition well educated. You have to be to teach people things. Right. And it takes time. It takes time for people to get to that level. We know about the historical issues in the country. I want to shift slightly. You said ethics are something that are almost innate to people. A little bit earlier.
Well, not quite, but go on.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So
stop strawmanning him.
I'm sure those were the words he used, but you can rewind at this point. What I wanted to discuss was ethics in general, and maybe some sort of touchy subjects. We had a little bit of a chat before we came on air. There are things that we kind of just have an assumption of this is right and this is wrong. And there are a lot of these topics that I've sort of been confronted with recently, like Ramon and I had a long chat about incest a while back. And they kind of make you think. It doesn't necessarily change your feeling, but it's, you go from being, I know that's absolutely wrong, to hold on, I'm not so sure. So
it's a fascinating phenomenon to watch when someone goes from a position of complete certainty about a moral truth or an ethical truth to doubt and then maybe even changing their mind. So as ethicists, what we ask of people whenever they have any moral intuition is to provide an argument for that intuition. So we have fundamental moral principles. Here's one, for example, is utilitarianism. So utilitarianism states that an action is right just in case it benefits society as a whole. Here's another
good one. For the group.
Well, it depends how you define society. It could be the group that you're in. It could be humanity. Different utilitarians define the group differently. Here's another one is Kantianism. So Kant has a few different formulations of his ethics, but Kant's formula of humanity says that an action is right if and only if, or just in case, it respects the dignity of everyone involved. So when you have a moral intuition or you're expressing what you think is a moral truth, we ask, so why do you believe that? You know, are you using a utilitarian justification here? Are you using a Kantian justification? And often what people do is these different underlying principles like utilitarianism or Kantianism, they're at odds with each other. They'll produce different results in different situations. But they'll use both. They'll switch from one to another depending on what suits them. So here's an example. A very famous ethical case is the trolley problem. So in the trolley problem, there's different formulations of the trolley problem, and depending on how you formulate it, people have different intuitions. But here's one formulation. So unfortunately, the trolley problem, just before I give it, was stated decades ago when there was no PC language. So it's not going to sound very politically correct. Anyway, so you've got this train traveling along these tracks, and it's going to hit this collection of people, say five school children. So there's five school children on the tracks. The train's going to hit these five children. It's going to be carnage. They're going to die. It's horrible. But if you flip the train switch, there's a switch on the tracks. If you flip the switch, the train will divert onto another track and hit a big fat man. The fat man is in all our philosophical cases. I don't know why, but there's the fat man and there's these five kids. You've got to flip the switch if you want to save these five kids, but in so doing, you're killing the fat man, or at least the train's going to hit the fat man and die. What should you do?
Yeah.
So that's a trolley problem. And depending on which underlying philosophical principle you hold, you'll support one or the other answer. You should flip the switch or you shouldn't. And what's so interesting is that even though everyone thinks that their moral intuitions are absolutely correct and no one else would possibly disagree with them, if you ask a group of people, if you give them the trolley problem, roughly half will say flip the switch and the other half will say don't. Yeah.
Because it's whether you kill by action or basically by you don't.
Or neglect.
Or neglect, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way of framing it. So a Kantian would frame it that way. But a utilitarian would say, well, it's five people versus one.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that. Yeah, yeah. So depending on who you ask, they're gonna give you
I don't know if you saw that thing on the internet recently. There was a guy who gave his kid the trolley problem. like a 3-year-old kid with a little train track, and it had the split, and he put 5 people on the track and one person on the other track, and the kid just took the one person on the one side of the track, moved it to where the 5 people were, and killed all 6.
I don't think that's consequentialist, or can't you?
No, it's neither. But awesome. I really enjoyed it.
It's just pure evil if it exists.
But so interesting that everyone's intuitions can differ so widely.
Yeah. On the incest debate.
Yeah.
Since I brought it up.
Yeah. So why do you think incest is wrong, Jonathan?
Because I was told it's wrong. that's probably the initial reason why I think it's wrong. I think a lot of beliefs we hold are because our parents told us that was wrong, or society told us it was wrong, or, you know, normative behaviors. I hate to use the
that's problematic
SJW language, but what we view as normal in our society. But yeah, the discussion Ramon and I were having, is it Jonathan Haidt that example? You know, a brother and sister go away for the weekend. Secluded nature reserve or whatever, no one around. He uses a condom, she is on contraceptives, religiously. Ha ha ha.
The key thing to this scenario, the thought experiment, is that they want to try it just once, just to try it out.
Yeah.
Have a bit of fun. For procreative purposes.
No one's going to see.
And there's no chance that they're going to have a baby out of it. They're going to have sex and no one else will know about it and whatever. And
question is,
where's
is
the
wrong?
Problem?
Right. So different ethicists will give you a different answer, depending on which ethical theory you hold true. So a utilitarian would say, does everyone involved benefit? You know, do they have a good time? And do they benefit in the long term as well? So they might enjoy the sex. So a utilitarian would say that it's wrong if they don't enjoy the sex and if afterwards they feel bad.
Okay.
But a utilitarian would say it's right, it's nothing wrong with it, if they enjoyed the sex and they feel fine afterwards. So a utilitarian looks only at their happiness, you know, how much utility is involved, how much happiness is involved. A Kantian would say, well, is their dignity undermined? And interestingly, Kant thought that all sex was wrong. So sex automatically undermines your dignity of any sort. Incest, non-incest, straight, gay, sex is bad. Okay. So Kant would have a problem with that, but modern day Kantians don't take quite such a strong line, but they might still say that your dignity is undermined because your concept of yourself as a brother or a sister is somewhat undermined, or maybe you feel really bad about it after you feel like you've lost your dignity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So different philosophers will give you different answers depending on the.
So let's move to a favorite topic of mine, voting. So, Jonathan... You must school Jonathan on this. I've tried. He's intuitively...
I'm lost. Just like the majority of voters around the world.
Exactly. And the majority of people around the world are idiots. That's why we got Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton running.
Crooked Hillary.
Crooked Hillary, sorry. So, voting, right?
Okay,
I don't see it, but please explain why it's not a bad idea, just that it's not immoral not to vote.
Yeah, I actually think it is...
I don't think it's immoral, by the way.
Immoral?
I don't think it's immoral at all not to vote. Okay. I don't think there's a moral argument there.
Oh. It's immoral to vote.
That's interesting because I think it is immoral to vote.
Okay.
Yeah. It's immoral to vote for a number of reasons. The simplest reason is just that your vote doesn't count. So it counts a minuscule amount, which in reality doesn't really make any difference.
Okay.
And during that time, you could be doing better things. You could just have sex and enjoy yourself during that time, or you could...
Have you heard George Carlin on this?
No.
He says the difference between me and you voting is that when I masturbate, I have something left to show for it.
So a utilitarian would say, well, if you can have a better time masturbating than voting... then you're doing the wrong thing because overall society is a less happy place when you vote. Another argument would be that when you vote, you are supporting a system which isn't just. So you're supporting a system, you're providing your implicit or explicit consent to a system which you might not agree with, or which I think is unjust.
Where's the pragmatic argument there in terms of that is a system we have? So Ramon's not going to vote. Ramon will never vote. Ramon will die a non-voter. I'm sure he's look at the grin on his face.
But you make it sound like I'm some sort of immortal being.
No, I'm making that like a very solid, like Ramon is definitely 75, 80, hopefully 100 years on the planet.
Still not voting.
And he's not voting.
Yeah.
He dies not voting. And the truth be told is that chances are, could be wrong, but chances are voting will still be in place. We'll still have democracies or
possibly
something.
Democracy is quite new. It might expire.
Yeah, it could expire, but unlikely in our lifetime, I would reckon.
Maybe.
Yeah, look, I mean, President Trump could change everything. Ramon wants me to get to the point. But
yes.
But the he'll die non-voter. The system won't change. It'll still be a voting system. And my argument would be I vote. I try to vote for the people who I believe will change the system, will de-escalate the system at some level, and slowly over time, it won't happen overnight, the system will change and will become just.
So whether or not the system changes won't be determined by whether you vote, though. You specifically, individually.
Yeah.
Because the question we're asking is, should you as an individual vote, not whether
the group.
We should have a voting democracy.
Yeah.
We're asking whether you, Jonathan, should vote.
But if enough people don't vote, then the three people who rock up do matter.
So I'm not sure. Suppose no one voted.
Yeah.
You would have a system I'm very comfortable with, which is anarchy.
God, I'm in the studio with two anarchists. It's like my worst nightmare.
Yeah, so I would prefer a system where no one. I mean, people often say, but if no one voted, we'd have disaster. And I say, no. If no one voted, we'd be much better off. Another argument. Remember I said earlier that my thesis is that social groups don't exist. Now, if social groups don't exist, the government doesn't actually exist right now. So voting is actually an illusion. You're not actually voting for any party that actually exists. There isn't a government. And when people say anarchy is a terrible thing, have you seen anarchist states? Horrible things happen. I say, but we're in anarchy right now. There's no government right now. We would just be making that explicit so that everyone understands that if no one were to vote.
Yes, I mean, that's what I keep saying. Is when I meet people at the coffee shop to talk about ideas, which I tend to do quite often, and I speak about anarchy, no, it's a terrible system. I said, okay, what did the state, you know, force you to be here today? Is the state going to force you to pay for your coffee? Is the state forcing you to get into your car to get you? No, you did it voluntarily. We are in a system of anarchy right now having this conversation. So just extrapolate that to a greater...
Is there no group of people who would show up, have coffee and walk out and not pay in an anarchy? Because in an anarchy, there is no one to come and enforce the law.
Right. So, I mean, so you might argue right now there's no one to...
I mean, there are things I would do. Trust me, I would drive home at 200 kilometers an hour if it wasn't for the fact that there might be a cop on the way home.
But there's a lot of people who drive at 200 kilometers an hour now.
Anyway, sure.
Yeah, and many of them don't get impacted or influenced anyway by the law.
Yeah, but some like me do.
No, but,
sure.
But sorry, if I may say, like speed limits are completely arbitrary.
No.
Scientifically, yeah. Not scientifically, through studies, they show that it doesn't matter how fast you travel, it is the relative speed of everyone around you at that time.
And your stopping
speed.
That's
what counts. That's what counts. If you got someone at 200 and someone at 40, that's where accidents happen.
Hmm.
If you're all traveling at 150, 160,
okay, back to the.
There's interesting studies that suggest that they've looked at death penalty examples where countries have introduced the death penalty or removed the death penalty, and it doesn't influence whether people perform crimes that would be punishable by the death penalty. So just because there's a particular punishment for your crime that the law stipulates, it doesn't necessarily influence your behavior. I think it's a similar kind of argument to the claim that atheists won't be moral. Okay. So people argue that you must believe in God because if you don't believe in God, you're going to be an immoral or amoral agent who's not going to do anything good in your life because there's no one ultimately to hold you accountable.
This is a good argument.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a weak argument because if you have a look at
well, I'm saying your side of it.
Oh, right. Argument. Oh, thanks. so I think there's an equivalent argument. It's a good analogy to this case. So just because people think that, you know, just because there's a law that says that your actions are illegal, that won't necessarily influence whether or not you perform those actions. You might find people like me who are anarchists who still behave pretty well, right?
Mm.
And you might find people who believe in the existence of the law and that democracy is a good thing being hypocritical and doing really nasty stuff.
I think those are called politicians, Jason. Yeah. The ones who create the law don't follow the law. Right. Yes. And they got special privileges not to follow the law. Mm. Yeah, I think they're called politicians. Mm. They talk about politician privilege for once. but Jason, going on to anarchy in particular, I know my reasons for being anarchist. What are yours?
Okay, so there's different forms of anarchism. In the philosophical literature, there's strong anarchism, there's weak anarchism. Weak anarchism just states that you're not obligated to follow the state's rule. Strong anarchists state that not only are you not obligated to follow the state's rule, but you should rebel against the state. And then my position is metaphysical anarchism, which is that the state doesn't exist right now. So it's not like I want to change. I don't think there's a state right now.
For someone who's listening and says, well, there's the union buildings and there's parliament and there's people who sit there and they make up laws and then there's people who run around the streets with guns and tell you what to do, how is that?
So I believe in what I see, right? What I don't see is the union buildings and parliament. What I see is a building. And I see a bunch of individual people sitting in that building and a bunch of individual people debating about what policies should be enacted. But I don't see actual laws being manufactured. And I don't see a union and I don't see a parliament. I just see individual people. Mm. I believe in what I can see. I, in that sense, I'm an empiricist. I believe in what I can see and touch and feel and taste.
So those people, it's back to your thesis, which is those people sitting in parliament, just because they're sitting in parliament and they claim that they make up a group called the government, aren't necessarily a group.
Correct. They believe they're a group.
Yeah.
They believe they're a parliament. They believe there's laws that they're creating or dismissing. But I don't think that any of those beliefs are actually true. I think there's just a bunch of individuals. A policeman, on my view, is not a policeman. He's just an individual with a gun who's telling you what to do. But he's not in the social sense a policeman.
Some thinking there.
I mean, I fully agree with you. I've actually read your thesis, Jason, a while ago, true, but I did read it at the time, and it was very persuasive to me. I was an anarchist already before reading it, by the way, but it was very persuasive.
Not going to give you any credit, eh?
No, but it helped me rationalize my views a bit better, or make them more reasonable to others. So what do you mean by there is no groups? We touched on this a bit earlier, but... One would think that a group is individuals together under a common theme or common intention or something to that effect. And you disagree. You say that doesn't exist whatsoever.
Yeah. So another way of phrasing what I'm trying to say is that there's no such thing. There's no difference between a mere aggregate of individuals and a social group. I'll give you an example. This is the central example I use in my thesis. So when I was in first year, there was massive protest at WITS. It was also a fees must fall equivalent movement. And it was really impactful for my development as a student, because I remember one day I was walking through Central Block at WITS University, and I looked up and there was this row of policemen, of riot police, and they were marching into the Central Block crowd, and they fired tear gas. It was incredibly visceral. And it struck me that there seemed to be something very different about that group of students who were protesting in what seemed like a very unified way. They were singing together, they were chanting, they were waving banners, ANC Youth League flags. They seemed to be very coherent. But at other times on the Central Block concourse, on a different day, at a different time, there's just students walking to their classes, some are having lunch, some are chatting. They're not unified in the same way. They're not interrelated in the same way or interacting in the same way. And on the one hand, with that sort of loose formation of students, I'd call that a mere aggregate. It's just a bunch of individuals in the same place. But it seemed like the other bunch of individuals, the protesters, the ANC Youth Leaguers, that was a social group, right? Mm. And the way I phrase my thesis is there's no real difference between the two cases. Now, there's lots of arguments that go into that, and it would take some time to discuss that. But that's the crux of it, that... there are mere aggregates. There's bunches of individuals that are just in a collective together at the time. But that collective, on my view, doesn't have the ability to act together. That's a core notion of a social group, that a social group can collectively act. They can protest. They can wave banners. They can collectively bring down a government. They can perform a coup of the universities or a coup of the state. They can collectively act. On my view, it's impossible for a group to collectively act. But what is possible is for a whole bunch of individuals to act individually. So I'm denying the existence of collective action, that there's a collective called white people or black people who can collectively perform an action, but there are individual people who believe that they're white who can do things, and individuals who believe that they're black and can individually act. But I'm denying the existence of a large social group that can act.
So are you saying that those protesters, when you saw them, they could all have the same set of beliefs at that time, so to speak, but their motivations are different?
Yeah, so I'm denying that there's anything in common with all those people on that Central Block concourse while they're protesting, that there's a single feature that's common to all of them and that no one outside the group has. In other words, I'm denying that there's a feature that's both necessary and sufficient for all the members of that group. I'm saying without that feature, you don't have a group. You've just got a bunch of disparate individuals who happen to be in the same place, but they're not a group. So Ramon, what do you think that central what do you think that central feature of all those people was?
Oh, right. Okay. So they all came together. They planned it beforehand in the meeting of sorts, and they all came to Central Block and said, "We're going to protest right here. We're the most. We are very visible to everyone coming in our Central Block, and we are going to protest about the fee increase that's happening in a week's time, and we are going to do so by chanting these songs,"
right?
For example.
Now, if you were to walk around to each of those people and you were to ask them, okay, what exactly is protesting? Because that what you're saying is that the central feature is that they've decided to protest. But you were to ask all those individuals, say, what's a protest? And what is it exactly that you're protesting against? And what is it exactly that you want? You'd get many different answers. You wouldn't get a single answer from all those people. So even though it appears like there's a central belief or a central goal, philosophers call it a telos, that there's a central goal or telos that all the people in the group have, I'm denying that there really is. Maybe in very small groups, maybe like a family, their central goal is to go away on holiday on Saturday. But even there, you know, you might find that the youngest kid really doesn't want to go, but he's going because his parents say he has to go. And you might find all those people on the Central Block concourse. A lot of them are there because they feel like they must be there because there's peer pressure for them to be there, because their friends say they must be there. But they might not actually share that goal to protest and to achieve a certain outcome. They might not even know what the fee increase is next week. They might not have been at that meeting a week before and decided. They might have been walking by and thought, oh, this is fun.
Yeah, some just want a free T-shirt or whatever the case might be.
Yeah, and although I'm sure many of the students in the Fees Must Fall movement do have some sort of noble goal, many of them also just were along for the ride. They were along for a destructive ride. There was there's incredible violence in burning down buildings, burning books, burning paintings, a lot of anger involved, and that probably had nothing to do with a central goal or telos. It was just rioting, insane behavior.
Okay, and how do you stop that rioting and insane behavior in an anarchy?
Good question.
Very simple. Insurance.
It doesn't stop the behavior, though. So they'll still burn down your house. Your house will get rebuilt.
Or private security.
You might employ private security, which is what Wits did in the last Fees Must Fall protest. You might also conceive of a world where this is possible. So I'm a science fiction author, and one of the books I wrote about, one of the books I wrote is called The Solace Pill, and it tries to imagine a world that's purely anarchist. There's no central governing body. There's no state. But technology has evolved in such a way that you don't need it. So there's certain problems with anarchism. One of them is enforcing the law. Another one is how do you make sure there's trade? If you don't have, for example, money to trade with, you don't have a currency. And I try to construct a world where technology supplies this. So I imagined a world where there's 3D printers that can produce whatever you want. Mm. And back when I wrote the novel about 4 years ago, 3D printers weren't as popular as they are now.
Yeah.
We're starting to believe that we can print pretty much anything with 3D printers.
Except a 3D printer.
Maybe you can print a 3D printer too. It's the equivalent of a replicator on Star Trek. So on Star Trek, they've got these replicators. Using this replicator, they can reproduce anything. So they can, using fundamental atoms, they can produce anything. And so having an object as a possession is worthless because you can just reproduce that object at any time. Mm. So that would resolve a lot of the anarchist issues. You might find that an anarchist state is only plausible or feasible once we evolve our technology.
And also once you eliminate demand issues of things, right?
Yeah, you might need to kill off half the population for it to work, or take half your population, put on another planet, or explore off-world. You might need a less populated system in order for anarchism to
in the
really
beginning work. Or in the long term?
So if, for example, we could spread off planet, we'd probably have to leapfrog from planet to planet as the population grows. So yeah. Maintain a long-term small population. Yeah.
So anarchy works better with a smaller population.
I think so, because you need infinite resources if you've got an infinitely large populace. If you've got limited resources, you need a limited populace.
And things like tribalism?
So say more?
Well, I'm just wondering, in an anarchy, it's kind of, it makes me think of those sort of post-apocalyptic movies where, there is an anarchy, essentially. The government has fallen. There's nothing. And, for some reason, they always dress the women like Amish people. I don't know why in a post-apocalyptic time that's what you dress in. But these small sort of communities which kind of come together as these, like, everyone working for each other type of concepts. If you in this kind of state
you have almost kibbutzim, these small
groups. What happens when you have different sort of groupings? I know it's a bad word with me, but you have someone who we have an anarchy, but there's two religious groups, and the religious groups, frick it, there's Jews and Muslims, right? And they specifically happen to be the only place that survived the nuclear war that President Trump started is Gaza and Israel, right? But all the government people who retreat into their bunkers are dead. So we have an anarchy, and fundamentally these people hate each other. So how does that work in an anarchy?
So there's different ways of dealing with this problem. The one is, imagine everyone believed what I believe.
Yeah. Okay.
Imagine everyone believed that there aren't groups. You wouldn't have these two warring sects, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that would eliminate that problem. But assuming that people do believe in groups, well, then it probably will devolve into
us versus them.
Yeah, us versus them, and establishing some kind of power of one group over another. I'm not saying that anarchy is inevitable, and I'm not saying that it's likely even. I'm just saying that it might be a better system.
Is there anything you like about democracy?
It's better than other systems.
It's the Winston Churchill quote.
Yeah,
it's the worst system ever, but it's the best thing we have.
Yeah, it's the best of bad possibilities. I think the best system would be no system, with certain technological insertions, like 3D printers for everyone, and maybe with moving off-world and halving the population. But is it likely to happen? Probably not.
All right, you've said moving off world a few times, so I want to go there, because you're a sci-fi writer.
Correct.
So you probably, like me, would love to go to space.
Yes, absolutely.
You would very much like to visit another planet. I don't know. Look, I don't know what your bank account looks like, but I'm very unlikely to go to space anytime soon. And unfortunately, I think by the time it becomes mainstream, I'll probably be dead. So what happens when we do eventually move off the planet, probably the moon first and then Mars, although Elon just wants to go to Mars. Good luck to him. I can't stand the man. But what happens when we move to Mars and essentially the human species becomes not the human species anymore, because those people on Mars become Martians.
Mm.
And from a medical perspective, they are physiologically going to change. So if you live on Mars, you probably won't be able to come back to Earth, because you won't be able to cope with our gravity. And over time, they will look different. They won't look like we – well, they'll be much taller, for example. Their facial features will be different. We're not sure if they'll survive, actually. Mm. What's the ethics of
there's lots of sci-fi novels about this. I'm busy reading one at the moment called The Spin. It's basically a world where Earth develops this membrane around it, which makes time pass much faster outside the Earth than inside the Earth. So for every minute that passes inside the Earth, 1,000 years pass outside the Earth. And they send a colony of Earthlings to Mars, but they don't have their own membrane around Mars. And so they evolve over 2 Earthling years, millions of years, or hundreds of thousands of years pass on Mars, and they become very different to Earthlings. And there's lots of sci-fi novels that deal with this. One of the interesting questions for ethicists is, are ethics specific to humans, or are they specific to persons? And my view is that ethics guide our behavior around in the way we relate to other persons. And a person need not be human, but they do need to satisfy a certain criteria. They need to be rational to a certain degree. I don't think dogs are persons. They don't have the degree of rationality required to be a person. But we still might think that there's certain ethical constraints in the way we can treat dogs. You don't want to rip your dog apart and fling him through the air and have dog ripping parties. You know, that wouldn't be considered ethical. But at the same time, you don't want to treat him the same way you would treat another human being.
Yeah.
Well, most people treat them better than they treat other human beings.
Yeah.
Not me, though. I hate my bugs. I kick them every time I see them.
And us colonizing the universe while we're still basically a warring bunch of apes.
Yeah, we need to prioritize. So I believe quite firmly that we need to destroy the Earth as quickly as possible, so we have to get off it. So at the moment, there's a very strong view that it's immoral to pollute. It's immoral to destroy the environment.
Yeah, we have to save the Earth for our grandchildren.
Yeah,
I mean, enjoy the Earth. Screw my grandchildren.
It's a really poor line of reasoning, and the reason why is because ultimately, with our population growth, the Earth will be impossible to inhabit long term. If we are going to survive as a species, we have to go off-world. We have to. And we don't seem adequately motivated at the moment. But if we destroy Earth, if we make it totally uninhabitable, we've got to leave.
That is superb.
I love that.
So, but okay.
It's the moral thing to do. Run your bath as long as possible. Waste water. It's the moral thing to
running.
Do. Leave your car running. Make sure you've got CFCs in your deodorant and your fridge. Yeah.
Throw polystyrene on the street.
Just walk around Joburg and deodorant cans at all the hobos.
It's the moral thing to. I'm not
I
sure
can't believe
the,
how moral
sure
the Chinese
hobos,
are. It's just unbelievable. All this time they've had the answers, eh?
Yeah.
That's actually a fascinating concept because I mean the population growth slows down once people become a bit richer and all that sort of stuff. Okay,
but not slow enough. So long as you've got positive growth in the long term, any given planet is not sustainable.
But it's still like a few centuries to go, though.
I wonder.
9 billion people is said to be the limit, but it's still not.
We're
going to
run
much.
Out of water soon. There's going to be genuine
issues. Isn't it though, you know, what you're saying is very interesting because the base of your argument is if we destroy the Earth, necessity is what drives human innovation, right? Correct. So at the same time, I would say that if we run out of water, necessity will drive us to invent ways to create water.
Possibly, but you can't keep doing that indefinitely. So the Earth has finite resources. You know, it's a big place, it's a big rock, there's lots of water and there's lots of stuff underneath the surface. And yeah, okay, but it's limited.
At some point.
Yeah, it's a limited resource. But humanity reproducing at an exponential rate is an unlimited curve, population growth. And you can't fit an unlimited quantity in a limited space, and you can't feed or provide an unlimited population with a limited number of resources.
Yeah, I think I'll disagree with you on that one. What's it called? Schumpeter. Spontaneous destruction. Creative destruction is the engine of progress. I think we will hit a peak population, and there will be ways to feed and clothe and whatever
without going off world.
Yeah,
and without mass dying.
Yes, no, so I think so.
That could happen. It's possible. I mean, logically, I think there's problems with that because of finitude and infinitude. But even if that were the case, you might feel that our quality of life would be much better if we had more resources.
Hey, don't get me wrong. I'd rather we go off world than stay here.
So even if you think that necessarily it's the end of humanity. Well, Jonathan can stay, and I'll go after the planet's been destroyed.
You can stay with the Wokey Pokey Brigade, and Jason and I will go to
the Wokey Pokey Brigade are gonna kill themselves off. Don't worry.
So, Jason, just to end off, well, thank you for coming, sir. It was great.
Thanks for hosting me.
Give a plug to your books. So it's sci-fi.
Yeah, science fiction
with philosophy in it.
Correct. Yeah.
Where can we find them?
So you can find my stuff either on my website, which is www.jasonwerbeloff.com, and I think Jonathan and Roman will be kind enough to put a link.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you can have a look at my work on Amazon. All my books are available for download on Amazon, physical or ebooks. And again, you can look for Jason Werbeloff on Amazon. And again, I'll provide them with a link.
Super. And where can we find you on Twitter?
At Jason Werbeloff.
Great.
And just before we arrive on the show, he told me he sells figures to some degree, and you sell a lot better than Eusebius McKaiser, which is not difficult, by the way.
That's right.
Dude, I haven't written a book, and I've sold better than Eusebius McKaiser. Okay,
Well, I hope everyone has managed to now knows what a good argument consists of or comprises of. Please start using them, especially against me, so I can come back on Twitter rejuvenated.
That's to the Wokety Pokety people listening, eh?
Indeed. Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you for hosting, guys.
Yeah, you can find the Renegade Report on Facebook. It's Renegade Report. Go give us a like. And please share some of our Facebook posts. Some people may never have heard us and maybe new to podcasts. We're trying to spread the word. You can find us on Twitter at Renegade_Report. As always, Ramon on Twitter at Roman Kabanak, myself at Jonathan_Witt. It's been a pleasure, and we will catch you next time.
Cliffcentral. The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.